Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. On late Thanksgiving evening in 2014, 50-year-old Bart Campolo declared to his father, prominent evangelical preacher Tony Campolo, that he no longer believed in God. This confession, which could have torn the family apart, instead brought Bart and Tony closer together as they worked to discover what they each believed and why, as well as what they could still affirm together. Why I Left, Why I Stayed, Conversations on Christianity Between an Evangelical Father and His Humanist Son, is a book that reflects a father and son's spiritual journey and how they evolved when their paths diverged. This week we will be speaking with one of the co-authors, the son, Bart Campolo, and next week we'll be speaking to his father, Tony. A little bit about Bart: he is a community builder, counselor, and humanist chaplain at the University of Southern California. He is also the founder of Mission Year and host of the popular Humanize Me podcast. He and his wife, Marty, live in Los Angeles. Hello, Bart.
Hello.
Welcome to Common Threads. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, well, thank you for having me.
Certainly, certainly. Before we get started on the book, let me ask you this. What are your duties as a humanist minister at the University of Southern Cal?
You know, I mean, what's interesting is that if I say I'm a humanist chaplain, people get confused. But, like, you know what a chaplain does, you know? Like, you build a community of people that are pursuing goodness in a particular way, and you counsel people when they're going through troubles in their relationships, and you show up at funerals, and, you know, you just try to nurture people's spiritual growth. And at USC, I'm sort of charged with nurturing the spiritual growth of all the students who want to be really good people and want to make the world a better place and want to cultivate a sense of gratitude for the privilege of being alive but don't believe in God.
And how does one obtain credentials of being essentially a chaplain without a faith tradition to help provide those credentials?
You just make it up yourself, Fred. You just declare yourself the humanist chaplain at USC.
Wow!
I'm half
really?
Kidding, but the reality is that what happened to me is that after I spent 30 years as an evangelical Christian, inner city missionary and pastor and preacher, and so I had a whole ministry life. And when I finally figured out that there was just nothing left for me of supernaturalism, that I had sort of all throughout my Christian life had sort of dialed it down, you know, kept moving farther and farther away from the supernatural side of Christianity and more towards just the values, until I finally reached the point where I was like, there's nothing left here. I don't believe in God. I don't believe in any supernatural forces. When that happened to me, the first question I asked was, oh no, what do I do now? You know, like, I'm a minister who doesn't believe in God. And I went looking for a community of people that were trying to pursue goodness in a secular way. And, you know, the first, and I went to a lot of atheist clubs that were, like, really full of angry people who just wanted to sit around and make fun of people who believed in God. And I wasn't interested in that. But eventually I stumbled into the humanist chaplain at Harvard, a guy named Greg Epstein. And Greg was the first person who I ever met who sort of showed me what secular ministry looks like. You know, that was sort of like, let's gather a group of people, not around what we don't believe, but let's gather them around the values that we want to pursue together. And, you know, around a kind of a shared narrative that says, hey, if this life is the only one that we have, how do we make the most of it? And so it was at Harvard that I sort of saw how it worked. And Greg introduced me to the dean of religious life at USC here in Los Angeles. And he was like, oh, you want to build a community like that? Come to our university to build one here. Half our campus doesn't believe in God, and nobody's nurturing those people.
So essentially, your evangelical ministry life was the prelude to this. I mean, that gave you the training of being a minister.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I mean, and what's funny is, you know, is when people, when, you know, when I work with students at USC, so, you know, I, sometimes, like, I'll give a talk to the students in our secular student fellowship, and afterwards, one of the kids will come up and go, was that a sermon? Like, I've heard of those things. And you're like, yeah, that was a sermon. That's a place where I, like, try to actually reach you emotionally and motivate you to do something that's in your best interest. You can take the Jesus out of the guy, but you can't take the preacher out. And I'm still, in some sense, I guess I'm still an evangelist. I'm still selling a message of good news. It's just that the good news is that you can live a wonderful life, in a secular way. And for a lot of people, that's news, because they sort of thought that if they didn't believe in God, being part of a community of people that collectively are going to pursue goodness wasn't an option. And that's it's very sad for some people when they lose their faith. They're like, oh, I miss church. I miss the music. I miss the Coverdish suppers. I miss the missions trips. I wish I could be part of something like that. I just can't believe that story anymore. And you sort of go like, hey, I understand that you can't believe that story. That doesn't mean your spiritual life is over.
Do you think that there has been an actual move, a transition, a maturity in the secularist community away from the angry atheist stereotype into the kind of secular community that you're talking about? I simply seem to hear about your kind of atheist or secularist more than I used to. I never heard about it before. Everybody was a cranky, angry atheist, and they all, when they left their religion, they did not leave behind the horror stories, if in fact there were horrible stories to be lived. And now I'm just seeing a lot more people here in Michigan, where we are, people who go out of their way to connect with the faith community in interfaith activities. So I'm just curious, as I say, is this something you've noticed, or perhaps we just didn't see this other movement all along?
Yeah, I think in some ways it's as much a social phenomenon as anything else. What's happening is, in the early days in this country, in 25, 30, 50 years ago, if you didn't believe in God, you better keep that under your hat, because it was social suicide. You couldn't get a job. You know, there were laws against having an atheist in government. You know, this was a Christian country, and you doggone better well believe in something. And so what happened is that in the early days, the only people that could be out secularists, out non-believers, would be people that were already socially marginalized. You know, because there was so much stigma attached to it, that the only people that could say they were out are people that were like, you can't fire me, I quit. They were already outside of society. And so the earliest out atheists were people that were a lot of times not very socially adept, and or maybe they were angry folks in any case. They weren't very social people. And so it's not surprising that the earliest secular organizers were people that were, they'd either been driven out of church because they were gay, or because, you know, for this reason or that, or they were just like, they just rejected the whole thing and they were pissed off. But I think what's happened now is that, especially in the wake of people like Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris, it all of a sudden became like, you know what, it's actually intellectually a credible thing. Like, you know what, there's a lot of people that don't believe in God. And then what happens is that then it becomes safer for people like me to say, you know what? Like, I'm not worried about being stigmatized. And then what happens is, as more and more people, there have always been a lot of atheists hiding in church pews who just couldn't say it out loud, I don't buy this stuff anymore, and they didn't want to lose their community. But as more and more of those people say, like, hey, this doesn't make any sense to me, the question they begin to ask is, well, gosh, that doesn't mean I don't want, doesn't mean I don't want to be part of a community. Doesn't mean I don't want to pursue goodness. And so I think what you are seeing is more and more people who are leaving church or leaving some form of spirituality behind, saying, hey, just because I can't believe in the medieval narrative that this thing is built around doesn't mean I don't want to practice, you know, goodness or I don't want to practice meditation, or I don't want to practice, you know, intentional loving relationships. And so I do. I think that what's happening is there's a huge bunch of people out there that can't believe in God anymore. And that's happening more and more. I mean, you can just study look at the surveys, you know, as the internet, as people get more and more information, as science kind of answers more and more questions, you have more and more people going like, hey, these narratives don't make any sense to me. But a lot of those people, just because they don't believe in God doesn't mean they don't want meaning and purpose and a sense of belonging. And so the question that we have to ask now is, what does religion look like for non-believers?
I was going to ask you, too.
What does the pursuit of life's ultimate questions look like if you don't believe in God?
Sure. And you mentioned before that you were in this life that was, you were enveloped by the evangelical Christian movement personally and professionally. And I'm just curious, how often do you find someone else who might mirror that existence? That is to say, someone who is so invested in their religion, again, professionally as well as personally, and then all of a sudden they hit some sort of theological or philosophical brick wall, and they can no longer honestly...
Oh, Fred, those guys call me every day, those men and women. I mean, the fact of the matter is that... ministers most of all. I mean, I know so many ministers in prominent churches that don't believe in God anymore, and they're all closeted. And the reason they're closeted is because their whole identity is caught up with that. It's not just their income; it's their sense of self. Like they're like, who am I if I'm not a minister? This is my marriage. This is my kids. This is everyone I've ever known. This, you know, it's the cost of coming out for these people, the cost of admitting that the narrative doesn't make sense to them anymore. It's just so high. You know, Upton Sinclair once said that it's very difficult to convince a person of something if their salary depends upon them. It's very difficult to change their mind about something if their salary depends on them not changing their mind. Yeah, and the thing is, it isn't that they're lying. It's that if you need to believe in something, you just don't entertain any thought that would challenge that thing because, you know, you sort of psychologically know, like, I don't want to go down that path. But what's interesting is the reason it's ministers so much is Malcolm Gladwell wrote a book a few years ago in which he detailed this idea of the principle of 10,000 hours. And the idea was that to become an expert in anything, to master anything, it takes about 10,000 hours of practice, whether that's playing the violin or giving a public speech or anything. Christianity that I grew up in, most of the Christians I knew never reached 10,000 hours. They only really thought about their theology for about an hour a week on Sundays. You know, and they were just living their lives. They just took it for granted. But the ministers think about it all the time. The ministers, that's their stock in trade, so they're thinking about it. So if you're a minister, you think through Christian theology. You think about the Bible. You think about, does the Old Testament match with the New Testament? And how is it that God is loving, but he's gonna destroy most of his children for not having the right theology if you're in the evangelical world? Like, they think about that stuff all the time. When they reach their 10,000 hours, they're usually about 40 years old. And they go, uh-oh. Because to master that theology for many people, to really understand it is to abandon it. They come to the place where they go like, this makes no sense. This idea of original sin, the idea that people are born deserving eternal damnation and that only through the gracious gift of Jesus can they be rendered worthy of any kind of life. Like that idea, like if you really think it through for a long time, for many people, not for everyone, but for many people, it falls apart under that kind of scrutiny. And so but by the time these guys figure it out, these men, these women figure it out, they're deep. Like, it's their salary. It's their life. It's, you know, they're 40 years old, and they're like, what am I going to do now? And so, yeah, you have a lot of people that are sort of trapped in that world. You know, now you'll talk to my dad next week, and my dad is not trapped like that. My dad really, the narrative really makes sense to him, and he loves following Jesus, and it gives meaning and purpose to his life. So, you know, not every Christian is trapped in that, but boy, there are a lot of them that are.
I was just going to ask you what you thought about your father, and there you told me. Let me break in real quick to mention for people just tuning in, that you're listening to WGVU's Common Threads. I'm Fred Stella, and today I'm speaking with Bart Campolo, and he is the co-author of the book Why I Left, Why I Stayed, Conversations on Christianity Between an Evangelical Father and His Humanist Son. So tell us a little bit about your... Well, I was going to say breaking the news to mom and dad, but before you talk about that, tell us about your experience with Christianity. You converted in high school, is that correct?
I did. A friend of mine in high school took me along to his youth group, and I was a nice kid, and I walk into a room of 300 kids in a rock band, and they're all singing about being good people and loving other people, and they're going on missions trips to feed orphan children, and it just seemed like a club for nice people, you know? And I was just hooked. I wanted to be part of that community. And so for me, you know, it's funny, like, a lot of times when you talk to secular people and they're talking to Christian people, or, you know, they're always talking about theology. But it isn't theology that draws most of us into Christianity or into the church. It's the loving relationships. It's the community. And so I was just drawn in. I just wanted to be part of that community. And I figured, like, okay, like, if I have to fake being a Christian to be part of this, I'll do it. And at some point in the faking, you know, for a few months I'm praying and I'm seeking and I'm going, like, God, if you're there, show up. And then at some point you have a transcendent experience. You know, at some point you're on a retreat and it's late at night and there's candlelight and everybody's singing Our God is an Awesome God. And you suddenly feel something and you go, like, this is real. I believe it. Something's happening here. And, you know, sociologists would explain it differently. They would say that's collective effervescence, or they would say you're getting swept up in a group mentality. All I know is it felt real to me. And so, yeah, I became a Christian when I was in high school, and I loved being a Christian. I loved it all the way through. Like, you know, I love that community. I love the stuff that we're doing. I love the music. If I could believe in the core idea that there's this good and loving God that made us and that ultimately is going to save us all and we're all going to live forever in utopia, if I could believe that now, believe me, I would jump right back in.
But you mentioned that you converted in high school. I'm just curious, what was going on at home? Wasn't your father already heavily invested as a minister?
Oh, yeah. And growing up, I mean, I thought my parents were wonderful people. And I knew my dad was a very sincere believer. The reason I didn't become a Christian until high school wasn't because my dad was a bad guy or I was rebellious. It was just like, even as a kid, the Bible stories made no sense to me. I mean, we learned a lot of stories when I was a kid about, like, flying genies and magical carpets and you know, dogs that talk. And the Bible stories always seemed to me to be just like those stories, like exciting and wonderful, but like not very likely to be true. And so my problem growing up wasn't that I was rebellious. It was just I didn't believe in God. God made no sense to me.
And how were the dynamics in the household of you holding these views at a young age and not being the perfect Sunday school?
When you're a little kid, you don't stand up and say, I think this is balderdash. What you do is you just go to Sunday school. You just go along. You're just a nice person. I'm like, this was the community I grew up in. And so I just sort of, you know, you just go along.
I mean, okay.
You know,
sure.
I think that for me, the older I got, you know, I was a nice kid. And in my family, being nice was the most important thing. You know, if you were kind, you kind of looked like a Christian. You know? And so... So for me, it wasn't really hard to kind of be in a church context because the values are values that I did and do think are wonderful. And so, you know, but when I became a Christian in high school, I remember sort of telling my parents, like, I've accepted Jesus Christ as my personal Lord and Savior. I hope you see a difference. And they were like, yeah, you know, you seem to be really into it now. And I really was.
I'm sorry. So tell us about dropping the big bomb many years later. How was that for you and your parents?
Well, you know, I think, and probably a lot of listeners on your show have had this experience of being on the other side of a faith divide with somebody that they love. And so for me, I mean, it wasn't as tectonic as you might think, because I really wanted to stay a Christian. And so throughout my Christian life, I kept changing my theology to try to make it work. You know, like when I realized, like, the churches that I was in were kind of, gay people were not okay. Like, it wasn't okay to be gay in my world. But, like, I went to college. I had lots of gay friends. And so I changed my theology to accommodate gay people. I was like, I started underlining one set of Bible verses and ignoring another set. And then, like, you know, I knew people that weren't Christians, and I knew they were going to go to hell if they didn't accept Jesus Christ. But, like, I decided, like, no, a loving God wouldn't send anybody to hell. And so I became a universalist, and I started underlining one set of verses and ignoring another set of verses. And so, you know, I kept changing my theology all along the way. And by the time, you know, and so my parents saw this migration. And so a lot of my friends said that when I came out as a secularist, they were like, it was sort of like coming out gay. They were sort of like, yeah, we knew. We wondered when you'd figure it out. But still, for my mom and dad, when I sat them down and said, hey, I'm not a liberal Christian anymore. I'm not a progressive Christian. I'm not a red letter Christian. I'm a post-Christian. There is nothing left. I can't use that language anymore. My dad was just devastated. I mean, I think it was hard on my mom too, but for my dad, I think it's a combination of, on the one hand, this is his community. This is the tribe that we were a part of. I was his colleague. We worked on ministry projects together. And so when I left, when I say I'm done, you know, he's losing his best Christian buddy, like the guy he works with. And the other thing is, he's famous as a Christian. And it's embarrassing when you're a famous evangelist and your kid, you know, like, turns away from the faith. Like, I knew this. This was painful for me. It's to know that, like, for the rest of his life, people would be coming up to him and saying, sorry about your son. Boy, that's really disappointing about Bart. Like, what happened? I mean, I hated to put him in that situation.
I can imagine that was painful for both of you. Let me ask you this. Now, let's say, right now, let's say that your father is right and you were wrong, okay? Let's just pretend that his theology...
You're going to Pascal wager me?
No, that's not it. Not going in that direction at all.
Okay, all right, I'm listening.
You were saved. If there is a heaven to go to, aren't you there? See what I'm saying?
Oh, you know, I guess it all depends on your theology. I mean,
I'm talking about your father. Yeah. Your father. Yeah, exactly. Doesn't your father subscribe to that? Or,
you know, you'll get a chance to ask my father, and it's
sure.
A good question for him. I think what I became very aware of in that moment when I told him, like, I'm done, and my wife and I sort of made this journey together, and so we were both sort of sitting there saying, like, hey, we're out of here. We're trying to figure out what life looks like on the other side. I think that we were both very cognizant of the fact that my parents aren't the kind of people who think that God is going to damn us to everlasting suffering because we have the wrong theology or because we're not capable of believing in him anymore. I think my parents are probably have a very gracious understanding of God. And my dad, I think, would probably even say, like, listen, you may not believe it now, but when you get to the pearly gates and when you meet Jesus, you'll know. And he's like, and if you change your mind then and you say, well, Jesus, can I embrace you now? I think my dad thinks that Jesus never gives up on this side of death or on the other side of death. I mean, the idea that death is this artificial deadline in which, like, God can't forgive you anymore. I think he would say, like, I think God can forgive you anytime, and God can receive you anytime you're ready to be received. And so I don't think I don't think the primary reason he's upset about me leaving the faith is because he's worried I'm going to burn in hell. But I tell you, I counsel a lot of people who have left the faith and are trying to have relationships with their family. One of the reasons we wrote this book was to try to help families that are in this situation. And I talk to a lot of people, and that is the sticking point, because their parents' theology says that they're going to burn in hell, and so their parents can't accept them as they are because they love them. and they don't want them to die.
Right, right.
And that's an incredibly painful thing, to believe that the God that you love is going to kill your child forever, is so painful that I have so much compassion for people whose theology puts them in that bind.
Do you have people in your fellowship at University of Southern California who come from other religious backgrounds aside from Christianity who have become secularists?
Sure. Ex-Muslims, ex-Buddhists, ex-Sikhs. Yeah, absolutely.
I'm sure it keeps you busy.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a wonderful thing because most of the kids in my fellowship, they may have grown up in those traditions, but like most of them, I would say at least half of them never believed in anything. They never believed in any supernatural force. They were secular from the time. And so what's exciting for them is that they've always looked on religious communities and said, wow, those people seem to be having a lot of fun and really caring about each other. Wish we had something like that. And so for them, it does keep you busy because there are all these, and secular evangelism is so easy. I mean, when I try to lead people to Jesus, I get them all excited about our lifestyle, get them all excited about our community, and then they'd say, what do I have to believe to get in? And you'd say, well, actually, you have to believe quite a few really unbelievable things to get in. In this kind of world of ministry, you build a community of loving people with a real sense of purpose, and then people say, well, what do I have to believe to get in? And you say, nothing. You don't have to believe in anything that you don't have evidence for. Like we're gonna pursue goodness on the basis of common sense, like on the basis of evidence.
Bart, I have
say,
to.
Wow, this is fun. This is really fun.
Bart, I hate to break this off, but unfortunately, we are out of time. But I want to thank you so much. This has been a great conversation.
Hey, thanks for having me. I so appreciate it, and I hope you have a great conversation with my dad.
I'm sure I will. You've been listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, and today my guest was Bart Campolo, the co-author of Why I Left, Why I Stayed, Conversations on Christianity Between an Evangelical Father and His Humanist Son. Please join us next week when I will speak with Bart's father, Tony, right here on WGVU.